until I put myself in their shoes and I realized the genius of this is it's so hard to rip the mask off. And I think the only thing that is going to bring the right to account for its racism is this motion that we see everywhere on the part of people of color of outrage against seeing every gain that was made rolled back, and seeing things like institutional police brutality just go unaddressed. And if it goes unaddressed long enough, we'll have another civil rights movement, which will then recreate the conditions of pressure from outside being applied to the elected officials. I do think, though, that we need to learn from the right that a lot of motion doesn't necessarily add up to a movement. And it's a far more powerful thing to create a movement that's networked, in which people are working collaboratively toward the same goals.
Gene Hardesty's book, Mobilizing Resentment, was published in 1999 by Beacon Press. You heard excerpts from her talk at the U.S. National Women's Studies Association in June 2000. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. Thanks to all Wings supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Listening to Culture in Motion. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning. Wherever you might be in the world, this is your twice monthly show with myself, Mike Crenshaw, my co-host, Ryan Danley.
What's up, Ryan?
We talk about the intersection of art, culture, politics, and activism. And today we've got a very special guest, Dave Dichter from MDC, Millions of Damn Christians.
Millions of Deaf Corporations.
Pick it.
Millions of Deceived Citizens.
We can go on and on with this, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's very heady times. I'm glad the election went for Biden. I'm glad we're not suffering another 4 years. I know a lot of people on the political spectrum are like, oh, how can you vote? I voted. I encourage people to vote. Not like I'm a big Democrat now. I do like some of the, you know, the Democratic Socialists, you know, that end of things, and encourage people to get involved. But congratulations for everything you do that raises the consciousness around you. And, you know, just dragging an extra 3 people to the polls, 10 people, 40 people, you know, it's all these mouse hairs together. Sure. So congratulations, you guys.
Yeah, this was a crazy week for it all. I mean, we...
It's still not over.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's really like... I mean, I think that, you know... You know, I don't think, like, it's really going to set in for us. I mean, because we're in a little bit of uncharted territories here with, like, you know, like, there was, like, a, like, I think as we start to dig into it and we see that, like, you know, specifically, like, the DOD might have been involved, I read, and, like, you know, there's a lot of news going on around there right now about, like, who all, like, was part of it, how they wouldn't dispatch the National Guard, and how we...
And there are, you know, 70 million... crazy, or 75, I forget, that voted for the guy, you right. know, like, he got more votes than the last election. It's really, you know, just a mindset of we're sharing this country, we're sharing everywhere we go, there's, you know, almost everywhere we go, there's people that have that consciousness of just angry, pissed off, you know, and taking it out on the wrong people, I feel.
I mean, you've been involved in politics and you've been involved in music, and your music has always been incredibly political. You started when, in like 1978, something like that, was it?
Yeah, you know, the band actually started in 79, 80, the Stains, but I was in a band called The Rejects right there in Austin, Texas, the year before, so I was kind of in the punk scene there, 78. And you want to compare it to back in the days?
Well, I mean, like, how is the message of, like, early 80s punk rock still so relevant in, like, today? I mean, it seems like, I mean, if you listen to you know, I mean, we're still dealing with the exact same issues, you know?
Yeah, well, Ronald Reagan, you know, who got elected in 1980, beat Jimmy Carter. I voted for Jimmy Carter. I voted for Jimmy Carter twice, let me say. In 76, I voted for him. But, it was that first... Not first, Nixon was that way as well. You know, grievance voting. People were mad. They're not going to let this country go anymore. And, you know, having lived back in that era, you know, the 60s were wild, you know, as far as culturally, and it scared a lot of people. And then Nixon got thrown out of office because of his gross breaking of the law. Mm-hmm. 72, and he got thrown out in 73 or something like that, and then Gerald Ford for a year and a half. And they created this, you know, the media, and of course this was pre-Fox, but the people that were out there doing it, Roger Ailes, and, you know, gave like this grievance attitude that I see that is very prevalent today. All those people that are just all wound up charging the Capitol building, there, something's been taken from them, and they're mad. They're mad as hell. They're ready to die for it. You know, like, it's real, and, you know, they're so wound up in that grievance thing, and it's been stoked by Fox News and then all that AM talk radio ever since. You know, we don't live in that world, so we don't feel that oppression, but it's been round the clock, angry, angry people, you know. Most of them are white. And a lot of them are males. And I never really, back in the early 90s, I worked somewhere. I worked in a car place in New York. And I first met a bunch of, like, Rush Limbaugh guys. I'd never met a Rush Limbaugh guy. I've been living in punk rock ghettos. You know, like, of course I knew they existed. But all of a sudden, there I was at work, and they, you know, and they had every bit of that, you know, feminazi, you know, attitude. And I think the right wing and all that, Fox and all that, Roger, they stoked that anger, and that's the, you know, and basically blame someone else, right. You know. So even back in the, you know, late 70s when Reagan won. Oh, let's blame all the black people causing all the trouble. Let's blame all the feminists. Let's blame, you know, everyone crying for their equal rights. We're tired of this. And they fused that with states' rights, and states' rights was totally just, you know, we like our segregation.
Right.
And we want to go back to the 50s. We're still angry about what happened in the 50s. So states' rights, states should decide. You know, whatever. Of course, they don't like it when they're talking about marijuana legalization or,
right,
or
like,
all that.
They love states' rights. States' rights is one of my favorite, like, political, like, jargon words that has become, like, so mainstream, because it's really, like, states' rights.
States' rights and wink.
Right. It's like states' rights, but really it's about, like, restricting states' ability to restrict your rights. You know, like, to for them to make the decision to, like, give a nod to the white majority, you know.
It's like people talking about trickle down. You got to wink, you know, like, you know, it's going to trickle down to you folks out there. Exactly. Yeah.
So,
so all those things, our task is making my stuff. I want to give a place, an outlet for people who have radical thoughts like I did. When I was 12 and 15 and 18, to like feel like, oh, there's some of us. Then it's continually to jump back into the deep end of crazy world and try to let it be known that, you know, you don't have to go crazy and be, you know, you can feel ugly about, you can feel bad about how things are out there without becoming Trump for president.
Right.
You know, and I think that's my task as we move into 2021 and beyond. Because they're still out there, those 75 million voters for Trump. And I have some people I know, and actually brothers, one brother who's a Trump guy. alienated, angry. Mom didn't give me as much as him. You had more rights, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, he always had that shtick, which was kind of in that complaining kind of, I didn't get my fair share. And, you know, painfully aware that everyone's getting their fair share, whether it's migrants, you know, well, whatever, you know, it's everyone's getting their share of the American pie. And, you know, we got to do a better job, and the media and the liberals and, you know, people of showing people they're not going to get left behind. Right. And of course, we're up against Fox News, you know, and billions of dollars of vested interest and billionaires and all these things that just people want, you know, for you to believe in trickle down.
Right.
So we're up against a Goliath, so to speak. And we are David with our slingshots.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
And I think it calls upon us as musicians, you guys as podcasters, and then maybe the listeners in whatever world they're in to somehow to try to get through to people that it doesn't have to be this way. You don't have to hate me for my politics. And a little side story, if it's okay. I lived in Hawaii for a little while. I was there a couple months a year. I had family there, and I'd go back there. I even bought 3 acres there. An ex of mine lives there. And there was these crazy Trump people. And in Hawaii, the Big Island, there's only 100,000 people in the whole Big Island. So the whole Big Island, the state of Connecticut, with 100,000 people, there's more people in southeast Portland than there is in the whole island of the Big Island of Hawaii. But there they were, these weird people, and they didn't like this, and they didn't like liberal teachers. And I was at the time, I'd just been done being a liberal teacher, liberal person, but it was a teacher in New York. And they're, oh, New York! You're a liberal talker, you're a liberal teacher from New York, you know, like, don't pickpocket me, you know. And they're joking, you know, and the way you meet someone in Hawaii, and Hawaii's got all these kind of community centers, because you don't know your neighbors. And you come up to the community center for a few hours on Saturday, and you meet everybody. You know, of course, you meet, you know, a fifth of the people that actually would go to something like that. But it would be interesting. And my lover was handing out meals and arranging for farmers to bring their produce to sell and trade and all that. And I got to meet these two people. They ended up living like 3 houses from where I lived in Hawaii. And, you know, we joked. They made fun of me a little, you know. I could almost hear the Jew York, you know, come out, you know, and they were doing that. And, you know, I laughed. I go, you know, Trump or nothing, you know, they, but, you know, still staring at me, go, take care, Dave. And then I'm driving home, and all of a sudden I hear someone screaming, and I stop the car. And there in Hawaii, you live in a dirt road, you really depend on your neighbors. It's a really neighborly thing. I hear the woman screaming, the wife, this couple. I can't even think of their names. But I parked the car, turned it off, and ran up there. And the guy was underneath the house, and he was pinned under. He was doing something with the foundation, and something came down and was on him. And I got there under there, and I put the other jack, and I... They loved me. You know, Jew York. You know... Yeah, and she cooked me a meal, and, you know, and to the point where I didn't always want to get, I knew it was such a trip, you know, they'd see me, there's David, you know, like, whether it was the parking lot at the supermarket or, you know, wherever, you know, and all of a sudden we were best friends, you know, I hate to think we have to go save someone's life, getting under their house and unpinning them from their faulty foundation job.
Like, that's what it's going
to
take.
To me, it was very fun. It was just so strange. So they love me. And it's really, the personal counts more than the political.
Most definitely.
And we got to find a way of personally interacting with people in a way that makes, you know, that makes you feel like, you know, I mean, you know, I'm not going to smile in his face and agree with him, but I'm not going to charge the Capitol and take a fire extinguisher and plow it over someone's head because they're trying to protect, you know, leaders of the country.
Did you ever have to deal with, in your music career, with being, you know, being in Texas, of all places, but also like being outspoken, being radical. I mean, I remember being in a record store as a kid and seeing the album with Millions of Dead Cops and the tank rolling over the skulls. And I remember thinking,
yeah, we had all that, you know. Borders were particularly tricky, you know. Doc from the Crucifix,
yeah.
Made this poster where he had policemen killed in the line of duty, and then that band comes to play with their band, with his band, a couple other bands, and then he had three new police cadets, and he put future dead cops.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, I had to meet those cops leaving the gig. They came there, and one of the organizers, the woman's mother, stayed with us, and I asked her, please stay with us. Because this was 1982, and it really was a different world. You don't get so many cops saying, oh, I listen to your kind of music, you know, more metal than yours. I get that a lot. But this was back in, you know, where they literally held up the button and said, this is your button. One day, we're going to plant you next to one of these trees you want to hug and save. Or, you know, three different times, I had cops threaten my life in the future if I come back around there. Now, that happened. And, you know, and border guards and this stuff, but, you know, they were so goofy, they hated everybody. You know, if you had longer hair, if you had a punk hairdo, you know, this was before Mr. T had a hair, mohawk. It was just, you know, it was just me and Divine and, you know, and a few British punks, you know, walking around Texas with a mohawk in 1980. And the ignorance, you know, there was a skinhead scene and that, you know, by 1983, 84, had a lot of them had gone white power, hanging out with the White Aryan Resistance, and moving up to, you know, Idaho to some, you know, some Metzger, you know, a guy, Metzger was one of the heads of the Klan and involved with that White Aryan Resistance. And we always had to deal with them at the digs, blah, blah, blah. A lot of stories out there, about to get my ass kicked, and then all of a sudden, I'm surrounded by suicidals, and they said, we're going down there, the LA Bash Boys, just random people saving my ass. Mm-hmm. And just because they figured out what was going on and, you know, and just backed me up at the right moment. I've been beat down once or twice through the years. I'm, thankfully, not so much. You know, like, I mean, for all my big mouthing, I keep Mother Mary near my heart. You know, I'm an anarchist, and I'm not the biggest religious nut, and I don't push or organize religion. But I had a health crisis, and I reached out to Mother Mary, and maybe she's looking out for me. That's all I can say.
Right, right. Yeah. What? So around what year was it that you, as a younger person, started to develop your radical political consciousness, and what was it that shaped that for you? Do you hear me, Dave?
I hear. Oh, me?
Yeah.
I thought that was to Ryan. Oh, yeah.
He already knows all about me.
You know, I was, you know, I don't know. I dressed up in my mother's clothes when I was 4 years old. I knew something was off, you know. But then, you know, as I was doing it, I was kind of like, you know, young, loyal American, you know, wanted to believe in World War II, wanted to believe in John Wayne, all that. And then the Vietnam War was really kicked up, and I was like 12, 13, 14, and all their stories didn't make sense. Why are we going after Ho Chi Minh, blah, blah, blah. And then the Democratic Convention, and then rock and roll, and then marijuana just made you an outlaw right at 13, you know, smoking that joint of marijuana. And so it was them against, you know, us. And it started happening for me in high school. And, you know, I was 12, 13, 14. Of course, that was 1969, 70, 71, 72. I graduated in 73 from high school. Then I went to college. And, you know, I'd wear my green peace button, but I wasn't out there in the middle of everything. But then there were some anti-nuclear protests. There was a long, very mellow period where there weren't many protests as I remember it, back when Jimmy Carter, after they got rid of Nixon and after he had to resign, And then Jimmy Carter became president. We had Willie Nelson in the White House, you know, putting solar panels up. We didn't have to do anything. We felt like, wow, you can take a break now. But, you know, like I said, I moved to Austin in 76, 77. And I went there kind of, you know, hoping I'd meet Willie Nelson or Jerry Jeff Walker, play him a couple of my folk songs and my country songs. And then punk rock just started to happen right around me at this open mic night. And I played a couple songs, and everyone, you know, was just like, when are you going to get a real band? You know, when are you going to do punk rock? And I realized I was a punk rocker. You know, I didn't kind of realize that, you know, I wasn't like, they were all 17, 18, 19. I was more like 20, 21, 22. And so, you know, I kind of graduated high school listening to, you know, Jeff Beck and, you know, it was more Parliament and all that. But, you know, and I wasn't even really hip to the MC5 or anything like that. But so I didn't really even realize you could do radical music, radical poetry in your music, you know, till about 77, 78. And then, of course, I heard Sex Pistols do, you know, Anarchy in the UK, and eventually The Clash, London Calling, and, you know, it's, you know, it was like, why not? And I started doing it. I wrote a song called I Hate Work. I played it on folk guitar, and, you know, my guitar player got it and played electric, sped it up, hardcore style. And I realized it was something everyone could relate to. And that's political without saying, you know, no war, no KKK, no fascist USA, which is also political, but right. It was also somewhat social. Uh-huh. Don't work a stupid job and waste your life.
Right.
So that it all came together there. You know, between the ages of, you know, I got radicalized in high school. And then by the time I was 22, 23, I was starting the Stains, which became MDC. And we were active. The Ku Klux Klan marched in Austin, Texas in 1980. And they kind of warned everyone, stay away. And everyone was like, you know, don't do anything. I think Jimmy Carter was still president. You know, and we were like, nah, we're going to go down there. And we were standing on the Capitol of Texas, which is like over an embankment looking down where the Klan were unloading and starting their march. And we just started throwing rocks. And so I wrote the song, which will become No Trump, No KKK, was No War, No KKK, No Fascist USA. And we were chanting it at them back in 1980. And, you know, that song got picked up by the demonstrators.
I'm sorry, Dave. You created that chant?
Yeah. I mean, I see your sign. Right now I'm working with MDC. We just did, we just got like 10 songs written, and we're going to write like 3-4 more songs. We've got an album, and we're trying to, you know, shop it to Epitaph and maybe Fat Records and maybe right. Cleopatra. Something a little more push, something more out there. And it's an exciting time to make music, make your lyrics. You know, the songs aren't, you know, as, I mean, I can't even write a song about Trump anymore. I got like 4 or 5 left right. that I haven't used yet. And I'm just sick of his face, you know, and I got to, you know, and I'm, as I'm talking to you, I want to write songs that heal the divide.
Sure.
You know, and I'm not foolish enough to know that that's all, you know, that it's going to happen so easy, but I'm still going to write songs that are pointed, political, John Wayne was a Nazi, things that I feel, you know, we are the multi-death corporation. But I'm going to try to reach deep inside myself and come up with things that are common denominator. We wrote this song called Well-Traveled Man, and Mike Smith wrote it. And it's almost like a Christian country rock song.
Right.
And just because the lyrics, I'm a well-traveled man, dun, 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 dun. I'm making music with my band, dun, 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 you know. And he's like, people of the world are all the same, but it's so, you know, it could almost get to like, Jesus Christ, Lord Savior is the man, do, do, do. You know, it's got that, you know, so if you see me in a Christian, you know, country label.
All right. It'll be.
I drank too much of the Kool-Aid.
Hey, it was great talking to you, Dave Dicker. Thanks for hanging out with us on Culture Emotion.
All right, I'm going to email you right away some things I got on my computer, laptop. Pleasure meeting you. We see each other when the pandemic's over. Come up to me if you're at a gig or,
all right.
You know, I know they're going to have, I don't know if it's going to happen this summer, but we played like the Portlandia Music Fest they had there. I think it was August or no, I forget when it was, but it was, you know, they got a few bars there on Hawthorne.
Right.
And called Portlandia. And we're tight with those people. They have a studio that we work with. So I know we'll be playing that. And,
my one and only love, my one. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 18th Annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 18th from 5:45 p.m. to 7 p.m., streaming online. The event honors the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and reflects on the relevance